My name is Jim Foster. I represent young Smith, who's doing 20 years statutory maximum for receiving images, pornographic images of individuals under 18 years of age. We are asking a remand in this case and suggesting that the sentencing procedures were tainted by procedural problems. We're suggesting that those procedural problems are, one, the court's mindset about the role of the Bureau of Prisons, two, the court's overemphasis on the guideline, three, the court's treatment of the defense therapist in this case. I want to start quickly.
What credentials did the defendant present to the court for Mr. Hunt? Was there a resume, a curriculum vitae?
There was no written resume presented. Rob Hunt testified. He testified that he had a undergraduate degree from the University of Chicago. He had a master's degree from the University of Chicago, social worker. He had been practiced 10 to 11 years. He had been certified by the DOC, the one of three people in the 5th Parole District. He did the probation work for Lake and Porter County, Northwest Indiana. And he had been a sex offender therapist of the year from the DOC the year before. He had had 18 years overall experience. 10 to 11 of those years was with sexual problems, both private and institutional practice. And that was basically it of his testimony. And
he had testified previously in these kinds of cases.
Multiple times. And his testimony, he typically testified, not in the federal system, I don't want to overstate that. His testimony, he had testified multiple times in the state system, primarily on behalf of the state as opposed to the defense, and that he had been obtained in this case to do a psychosexual evaluation of L.G. Smith. And I want to finish off on the BOP because I think that's a quick place to go on one of the points. The court, in a nutshell, suggested its understanding that the BOP could treat, and when cured, this individual could be released. Now, the government suggests that maybe the court was referring to a 3582 hardship. The court was in no way, shape, or form talking about a petition under which the court had discretion. The court was talking about unilateral action. And I call to the court's attention, it's in the appendix beginning page 39. And I think I put it in my brief, too, but it's important, I think, for me to repeat. This is the court. My experience with dealing with people that I have sent to institutions, they have experts in all fields. They determine whether people are treatable, how long they're treatable, and if they're cured, then they can release somebody I had given life to at any time. Once he hits the Bureau of Prisons, it's up to the Bureau of Prisons how long they're going to keep them up to the maximum that I give them. In essence, what the court was saying is, mine is an advisory imposition of sentence, and it's the Bureau who will determine when young Smith is released.
Well, he's talking this within the context of whether or not Hunt is a viable witness.
It came up during the time Hunt was in the room. And it was part of that colloquy, but with respect, Judge Mannion, I don't believe that was directed towards Hunt's qualifications or lack of same as the court saw them.
Well, then the court sort of blew it off, so that's neither here nor there. I mean, went back to...
Well, you know, when somebody says that's here nor there, because there was more colloquy than that. There was a suggestion from the defense that this person was going to do 85% of that of his time and nothing was going to change that. And he did say that's neither here nor there. But he also, in quitting, says, but my understanding is that the Bureau have a lot to say, but that's neither here nor there. Now, that's a district court telling all of us that it's neither here nor there that I believe that the Bureau of Prisons can release this person when they find he's cured. He basically invoked what I understood they had in Tanzania about 25 years ago. We'll keep you until we think it's time for you to go, and then it's up to us to send you.
Well, now, you think that this issue here then about he thinks they'll let him out at some earlier time when he got down to the sentencing and the time and et cetera, that he was basing it with that assumption in mind?
You know, he didn't tell us that, but I don't know how even the government suggests that under Williams it's harmless because it didn't have anything to do with the sentence. Now, Williams tells us that you folks have to find that it did not influence the sentence. Now, I would submit to you that it defies all human logic and experience to think that if the sentencing person is of the belief that the Bureau of Prison can hand out an early release whenever they feel this person should has been, quote, cured, end quote, I submit to you it has to affect you. I think that's one of those, Judge, where we tell the jury, don't think of a yellow canary. And that's the immediate thing we think of. And with respect to the trial court judge, to say it's neither here nor there, this wasn't just a short quip. This was about a moment, 30, 45 seconds of dialogue where he was making it clear what he thought the Bureau, how he thought the Bureau of Prisons could weigh in. And I simply don't think, I think we have to believe him when he says that's what he believes. Now, my suggestion to you is any person, you people sitting as a judge, if you believe that somebody else can look at your sentence again and that someone can release one when he's found to be cured, that's a whole new mindset of way you look at sentence. I mean, that's really a safety net. From a judge's perspective, I think that would be a very relieving feeling. Well, whatever I do, the Bureau of Prison can turn him loose whenever they want to. I think there's no other way to look at that than to say that had to affect his perspective of the sentence.
And it's certainly all occurring in the context of the judge discussing why he's rejecting the credibility of the proffered expert.
It happened
because he doesn't trust his opinion because of his experience with these issues involving people that he's sentenced previously. That's how I understand the broader context.
But I didn't see that context any way suggesting that it had anything to do with that.
That's how he wraps up the discussion.
Yeah, but the way I present that, see that colloquy, he's talking about experts, and he's talking about, and he's telling us he doesn't think much of this expert. But he goes from that, his mindset then is that makes him think of experts, and that's where he says, my experience is that the institution have experts in all fields, and that they determine whether people are treatable, how long they are treatable, and when they're cured. See, I don't see this as limited to his thought pattern about Rob Hunt, the therapist. I see him talking in therapists, and then he's saying, and his mind went to the segue of what the experts in the BOP do for him. The guideline emphasis is throughout this. Also, when he was talking about the expert, there's a point in the expert, and this is, again, the appendix, page 38, where he basically calls us to a sidebar and in effect, asks the defense, where are you going? And in response, it suggested to court, you have a choice between the mandatory minimum and whether the statutory limit. And the court says, no, I have to go back to the guidelines. You better tell me why the guidelines are improper. Now, the government points out that there's places in here where the court does what all of us do today, that we say post-Booker guidelines are only one of the factors. But clearly, I mean, this is taking place March 2. He's clearly saying, you better tell me why the guidelines are inappropriate. Subsequently, in his sentencing back in February of 08, and again, page 46 for a reference, page 45, 46, 48 for a reference, when he's talking about the home life of L.G. Smith, and he says the court does not feel that there's a sufficient basis for departure. Page 48, it says, and this is a little scrambled, so with respect, the court finds no reason to depart from the sentence called for by the application of the guidelines, inasmuch as the court has found the facts in this case to be fair and reasonable, and finds that the guidelines are fair and reasonable and are the kind contemplated by the Sentencing Commission. We were giving lip service to both sides of the coin, with all due respect, because there's colloquy in there, and the government points it out in their brief where the court's saying, yes, I acknowledge they're only guidelines. But I think it is clear that the court is giving more than guidelines. In the plea itself, when the plea was taken, the court says, and this is in the government's brief, if the guidelines are found are not found to be fair and reasonable, I can go higher and lower. The court sees the guidelines as a hurdle to jump. If they're not fair and reasonable, then I can do something. The authority in some cases, says the court, I will have authority in some cases to give more or less. This court has authority in all cases to do more and less, and I see that red light.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll give you a minute for rebuttal. Okay, Mr. Kolar. I can finally say good afternoon to someone.
May it please the court, good afternoon. Briefly, Your Honor, I want to put this in perspective. The defendant has stressed in his brief the need for a sentencing judge to really consider an individual assessment of the facts. Respectfully, that's exactly what the district court did in this case. The district court saw before it a defendant whose previous convictions and charges ran the gambit from narcotics offenses to possessing an explosive device to fraudulently writing checks. The instant case involved a significant amount and very troubling child pornography. Two computer hard drives, one of which had over 500 images and one of which had over 3,000 images. Among those images were videos. Some of the videos showed sadistic and masochistic sexual conduct involving minors.
But let's get to the issue, and it's this. How do we know that the court was not influenced by this misconception about the BOP's authority for early release? The court seems unconcerned about Smith's expert because it assumes that a BOP expert will decide whether Smith can be released early. And reading it, I certainly felt that the court was under the impression that in sentencing Smith up to a term up to 20 years, he was doing that instead of a flat 20 years. And I'm not convinced that can be harmless error.
Your Honor, I think it's harmless error for a number of reasons. One, the context, and two, what the judge said in this case. This comment about the BOP was directed specifically at the defense expert, Mr. Hunt.
And that's wrong. It's a ridiculous comment.
It is wrong, Your Honor.
It's a crazy comment. Forgive me.
But
any of us who've been district judges, my goodness.
I will not disagree with the court with that statement. But I do think we need to put it in context. And it is harmless error because it's directed specifically at the expert. And the court makes clear that it did not reject the expert because of these concerns about BOP. It rejected the expert because he couldn't make the diagnosis that he was claiming to make. The court again and again said, I want to see some qualifications, and I want to understand how this expert can make the diagnosis that he's claiming to make. So when the court makes this comment about the BOP, that's completely unrelated to why it rejected the defense expert. And it says as much. It says it's neither here nor there.
Look, whether to accept the expert, not to accept the expert, I really don't care about that. That was a discretionary matter that's solely in his hands. But, and I think it's irrelevant as to when he says what he says. It's obvious that he has this idea in his head that the BOP can somehow override his sentence, and that is scary to me.
Your Honor, respectfully, I do not think that that is the idea that was in the judge's head when he was sentencing the defendant, and I think that's very clear from the record. First of all, when you look at the entire transcript, not just the portions that were quoted, it's clear they're talking about the expert. Mr. Foster, while I don't know the issue came up, they're talking about the expert. I would like to address then some of the things he said. He, Hunt, said, the court, you can address it, but like I said, I'll go through it. And that's when they talk about the BOP. At the end of this, when Mr. Foster says that he's not following him, Judge Lozano makes clear, you know, I think this is a pre-guidelines case. This is something that was from a while ago. The judge never says he thinks that it's necessarily the case before him. that this defendant is somehow going to get out. Respectfully, it's certainly not akin to what the defense has claimed, that it's somehow like Tanzania, where we just send people to jail and let someone else decide. The judge held four sentencing hearings. He carefully considered the guidelines. He went through several 3553A factors. In the intervening time period between some of these comments that defense counsel points out in the sentencing, significant Supreme Court cases came down. Kimbrough came down. Gall came down. And to be clear, the court clearly, the court, when you read what it said when it imposed the sentence, had looked at that. Because if anything, it's going too far and not providing the guidelines enough credence, because you are supposed to calculate them first. And it says, quote, after considering all the facts in this case, the arguments of counsel, and the evidence presented during the sentencing hearing, and after later considering the sentencing guidelines and finding them to be fair, it is a judgment of the court, and then it goes on, the court goes on to impose sentence.
Well, he said things like, you better tell me why the guidelines are improper, and no, I have to go back to the guidelines. Now, I'll grant you that he also made comments about the advisory nature of the guidelines. But when there are conflicting comments like this, why not grant a Palladino remand? This court has granted Palladino-type remands in very similar situations where the judge made these kind of comments.
Your Honor, what's different here is the timing. This isn't one sentencing hearing. The court carefully had four separate sentencing hearings. In the middle of these sentencing hearings, and after these claims were made, the court came down with Kimbrough. The district court, after initially making those statements, clearly said, look, I'm not giving credence to the guidelines more than just a guidepost. And beyond that fact, there's multiple colloquies that are pointed out in the brief where the court and defense counsel are essentially agreeing as to the proper application of the guidelines and 3553A. And if you read the entire colloquy regarding the guidelines, when he says you have to show me why the guidelines are improper, what he's really saying there, he makes clear, once Mr. Foster says, no, I'm talking about 3553A here, the court says, quote, as long as you're going to 3553. Is the court calculating the guidelines at certain instances and looking at 3553 and others? Yes, but when it's pointed out to the court and when the court says exactly how it's considering the sentence, it's clear that it considered the 3553A factors and happened to also find the guidelines to be fair and reasonable. And that's something that this court should expect to see time and time again. As Rita said, you have the guidelines that were specifically directed to take into account 3553. You have district court judges who are specifically directed. So it's no surprise when they come out the same. The Supreme Court has noted that. So I think what's important in this case is really to take into account the timeline and when Judge Lozano said what he said. The comment about the BOP was strictly related to an aside that he said it's neither here nor there. It was in the context of whether or not he was going to look at this expert that he had already discounted for completely separate reasons, and it's never brought up again. And defense counsel makes much of, well, the no reasonable person could have that in their mind and not use it as a safety net. Well, respectfully, the judge misspoke, and I think he was thinking about older cases. He makes clear he's talking about a pre-guidelines case, that he's not saying that's the case now. Why would he hold four separate sentencing hearings, have testimony? I mean, if the judge really felt that way, he would consistently say, well, I'm giving them the max and let BOP sort them out. And the other thing that's important in this case, there were three counts.
At what sentencing hearing, which of the four did he say this?
The comment about BOP was at the second sentencing hearing.
Second sentence.
In November.
Maybe somebody took him aside.
And that is not in the record, Your Honor, but very well could be the case. The last sentencing.
The law clerks, perhaps.
The sentencing wasn't until February. And, what clearly is true is in the intervening time period before February, there's a lot of Supreme Court cases coming down. You know, a responsible judge is going to be reading those and thinking carefully about sentencing and taking out of their minds some things they might have thought about from, you know, decades and decades ago when we had an entirely different sentencing regime. The fact that the judge, on February 11th, when he sentenced the defendant, said what he did and evidenced a clear understanding of the proper weight that 3553A is to be given is what this court can look to say the record is clear, it's harmless error. I see my time is up. Can I briefly finish?
Of course.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You sat in here all day and you asked me that question.
The fact that on February 11th, after these Supreme Court cases come down, the judge evidences a proper understanding, does not bring up any comment about BOP, that is what this court should look to. No one, the defendant has not even raised the issue that the expert was actually qualified, so all we have is an expert who was not qualified. We have the defense who time and time again in front of the district court said, if this expert isn't qualified, then I can't make this argument, which also goes to harmless error. If the very person you were relying on to make the argument is no longer there, then and you've argued time and time again to the district court, well, I need a continuance to make this argument. You know, I think it's clear that there is harmless error, and the court can affirm and understand based on the judge's February 11th pronouncement of sentence and his rationale for that sentence that he properly considered the 3553A factors and the guidelines.
Thank you, Mr. Kolar. Came, Mr. Foster, one minute.
Okay, understood. I find that everybody in this room seems to agree on one thing. It was error. And now the issue is, was it harmless error? And with all due respect, the government's saying, let's look at this part of the transcript where he didn't say it, and let's look at this part of the transcript where he did say it, and let's divine that it did not affect him. I'm suggesting that we also look way back in February when the final sentencing came down. This could have been, as I put in my brief, it could have been a moment of compassion, or it could have been the same mindset that we're wondering about now. Also, the appendix, page 47. The court says, hopefully this sentence will allow the defendant to be treated in an effort to cure his psychological and medical problems in this area, if possible. Now, that was February 11, 2008, when the judge was talking about his own sentence. Maybe, like the government says, his mindset didn't mean that. Maybe, like I'm suggesting, he hadn't changed that mindset, and it's still in his mind of February 11. Perhaps the sentence I've just handed out will permit him to be cured. We have a young man, 23 years old. We have a time limit of 5 to 6 weeks of his life where he collected things. We know that to be because the subscription ended. This young man's entitled to a sentencing procedure that's procedurally free. We shouldn't guess. Thank you.
Mr. Foster, were you appointed?
Yes, I was appointed on this case.
Well, you have just the enormous thanks of the court for the remarkable job you've done here for your client.
Well, thank you.
And you, Mr. Kolar, have the thanks of the court for the great job you've done for your client as well. And the case will be taken under advisement.